your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Metaphysical, paranormal, you know, all those things you've been wondering about. Are you ready to go deeper into the realms of the unknown? I hope you've got your walking shoes on, because life is an adventure, and this is the journey. Come on, let's go.
I'm Jen Cruz, your host tonight. This is the Journey Radio Show, and we're going to be talking about cryptids over in Britain, and we are so excited about that. So, of course, I'm showing up as the She Squatchers. Unfortunately, my fellow She Squatcher, Jenna Grover, is not going to be joining us tonight. She's feeling under the weather, and I'm going to miss her so, so much, but it's okay. We'll get by. We've got a very awesome guest on the show tonight. We've got Andy McGrath from London, England. He is the author of the Beasts of Britain book, and he's got a TV show in the works also by the same name, The Beasts of Britain. And so let's just bring him on the show so he can tell us all about his past and present and the upcoming future as well. Hello, Andy. Are you there?
I'm here, Jen. How are you? I'm very, very happy to be on your show, lovely.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you could join us. And I hear it's 3 a.m. in London right now. Is that true?
It is 3 a.m., but as an old-time musician, I'm still on music time. So 3 a.m. is fine for me.
Oh, it's just getting going party time right now, isn't it?
Just a bad. Well, I'm faking. I'm really tired, but yeah.
Well, thank you for staying up late to join us on the journey tonight. And really, you're going to be taking us on your little journey of how you've started your life in the, as a cryptozoology enthusiast. And you got involved in all of this wonderful world of mysterious creatures. I can't wait to hear all about it. And I'm just going to let the listeners know, I met Andy. He was one of the speakers at the CryptidCon convention. It was CryptidCon Bigfoot Monsters and Legends in Frankfort, Kentucky, just a couple weeks ago. And he is just an amazing guy. We just loved hanging out with him. And he was an awesome speaker there. And prior to that, the weekend before that, you were speaking at Lauren Coleman's event. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. So I started in Maine at the International Cryptozoology Conference number 3. And it was me and people like Jeff Meldrum and Todd Desitel and Katie Elizabeth and Alexander Petikov from Small Town Monsters and some other people. And I did 5 days in Lake Champlain in Vermont with Katie Elizabeth, the champ lady. And she took me through her whole daily champ hunting routine and all of her evidence, which was amazing. She's amazingly dedicated to this hunt. Then I met the beautiful She Squatchers at CryptidCon amidst others, and it was just awesome.
It was so awesome. We just loved meeting you and hanging out with you and dancing with you and singing
yes.
with you.
I got to sing. I was so happy. My children don't let me sing. They don't want my daddy to sing. So, and of course, as a singer, I always want to sing. And they said, Daddy, shh, no more singing. So it was good for me to just get to belt one out, you know, for the night at least.
Yes. fun. Oh, it was great. And so for the listeners who weren't at the CryptidCon party, they had karaoke going on in one of the rooms. And we found out that Andy used to tour as a musician. And so he was signing up for several songs. And even our own Jenna, our She Squatchers Jenna, she's quite the singer. She sang some Janis Joplin, and I do have it on video. She hasn't allowed me to share it, but I have it for anyone who's offering big bucks. I might be willing to
share. She was awesome. She was so great.
She was awesome. You know, I think musicians are often their worst critic, their own worst critics sometimes.
Of course, of course.
Because I thought she sounded amazing.
She did. I mean, I'm still going through the whole two slightly tired songs that I sang and critiquing the little sort of drops in key and all the different things that happened. Whereas, really, I mean, let's face it, it's karaoke. You're not supposed to sound good. Actually, it's against the rules. So all of us that night broke a lot of rules in rocking it out.
Did we break rules? I didn't sing.
We broke the rules in doing it the right way. We're just not supposed to. It's supposed to be for people that can't sing and who want a good time. That's karaoke.
Yes, yes. And it was good. But, you know, most of the singers who got up there were amazing. I just have
great.
To say that.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing. I was like, whoa, I thought this was amateur karaoke stuff, but how many of you were like professional singers in the past?
Well, I think that a lot of failed musicians seem to drift into cryptozoology, people like myself, because we're already on that open path to, you know, different things, I guess. And it's also an exciting and unknown area to get into that's almost as unprofitable as music for the individual, so it has that same attraction point. Yeah, but you could make less money in cryptozoology. So, you know, us guys who are used to that kind of life, we were very attracted to that.
Really? Is that how that goes? Okay. So we got a new theory going on, and it could be a crossover book from musicians to cryptids.
Yes.
The cryptid musician.
Yes, exactly. We can have that crypto music currency soon, right? Yeah.
So tell us about how you got into cryptozoology. What was your first time that you realized you were into these odd creatures that other people aren't too sure about?
I mean, it was in the, I guess it was in the early 80s. So I'm in my early 40s now, and it was in the early 80s. And just the normal stuff, Nessie, the Paddy footage, Arthur C. Clarke's mysterious, I was calling it Mysterious Universe, I think it was Mysterious World, and the Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of program and things like that really just grabbed me. And of course, in the UK, there were always Nessie reports every year. You know, every year you go through the list of Nessie reports that come out, and is it 3, is it 11 this year? Which ones are a head and neck? Which ones are just a bit of a bump or a strange wave? So we've always got that thing turning over, you know, the big Nessie tourist machine turning over every year and wading through the sightings and what they might be. So that's a mainstay. But over the years, I got into a lot of the American cryptids, like the Sasquatch and Bigfoot and things like the Jersey Devil, and which is collected stories. I wasn't serious. I was a musician. I just collected these things privately and kept them in my home. And then I hit 40, and I work and live in London and do my crazy commute every day. And I've got 2 kids. And my wife said, "Look, you know, you've got no friends. You work 50 hours a week, commute 3 hours a day. Why didn't you get a hobby? What about this monsters thing that you're into?" That's what she calls it, the monsters thing. And I said, "Oh, what do you mean?" "Well, why don't you write about it?" So I actually thought, well, no, wouldn't it be great to have a TV series? Because, you know, Monster X and Monster Quest and all these different things, they've finished, they've ended. And we've got Finding Bigfoot, but that was also in the sort of the latter part of the series. And I started pitching it to people like Carl Shuker and Adam Davis, just out of nowhere. I just thought I would do it with total sort of hubris and lack of awareness of the subject. And then, of course, I came up against lots of walls. And they said, "Well, why don't you write a book first? Because then your idea will be more protected." I just started blogging. And then the blog slowly turned into this book. And I found so much information, not just about Nessie, but about the British Bigfoot, which was a new one for me, and the Dogman, or as I always call that, you know, the rebranding of the werewolf, little people, unidentified flying cryptids in the UK, the big cat phenomena, which is huge here, and there's so many sightings. And the book just grew and grew and grew. And by the time I finished, I actually had to cut it down from about 400 pages to about 230, 240, just because it was just too much information, you know, just lists and lists of sightings. Just try to make it a little more compact. And then people started liking it and asking me onto their radio shows. And I didn't think anybody would be interested at all in any way. I was just kind of sending it out there and sharing it on a couple of pages and, you know, dealing with the inevitable trolling that came after each post that I put there, cutting my teeth, so to speak. So that's it. This is why I'm now here. And I did these recent talks in the US and other things that are coming up, like the TV trailer that I did for the series Beasts of Britain. It just seems to have snowballed. There's some interest in the subject. I didn't really expect it would take off. And I'm kind of seeing what happens.
Well, anybody out there listening, looking for an amazing new TV show, I'm going to totally recommend Andy McGrath and his Beasts of Britain idea for a TV series. Let's get it on TV, people.
There's a little teaser trailer online, YouTube. You can just go Beasts of Britain teaser trailer, and it's all there. And it's about Bo Nessie, the lake monster of Lake Windermere in Cumbria. So you can always have a look. No pressure.
All right.
See what you think.
Well, maybe somebody out there will find that link and put it in our chat room for us.
Oh, yes.
That would be greatly appreciated. Jenna normally does this. But she's sick. I'm sure somebody will do it for us. Thank you, everybody. But Beasts of Britain, what is it called? Beasts of Britain?
Beasts of Britain, teaser trailer. That's the title. And it's just a mock-up of what we would hope to make if the series, you know, was commissioned.
All right. I can't wait to watch it. I wish I had seen it before.
Sorry. I should have sent you a couple of links.
Well, I've met Andy in person, and he is just an amazing guy, and he knows his stuff. So I'm sure it's quite wonderful. I would watch it for sure.
Thank you.
Yes. Put it on TV. And I think probably our American television networks are a lot more into that kind of thing, aren't they?
I think that you're just American people. Now, this was one of the things I liked about my trip. It was an eye-opening trip coming to the US. I'd never been before. And I only have Americans from TV as my example. So the eye-opening thing was that you're very open to ideas and willing to give things a try. You'll take risks on things. And the other thing that is that you're all very, very polite. And I mean actually polite, not like fake polite. Like we are in the UK. We use lots of polite language. But I figured out over the years that it's just a way of avoiding confrontation or saying mean things to people and protecting yourself against any comeback. You know, because it's like telling people that their house is quaint. It could mean that it's very nice and diminutive and beautiful, or it could mean that it's just really small and crappy. So, you know, it's one of those things. And I really loved it over there anyway. I just liked, I got off the plane, and every single plane I got off, everybody got up in order and waited for the people in front of them to get their bags and get off the plane. And I was like, what kind of insane country is this? What's going on here? You know, why are these people waiting for the people in front of them to get off? Surely they need to trample them to the ground and run to the front.
Is that what happens elsewhere?
Most of the places. I mean, I obviously, when I got off in London, that was more or less the scene. Not as bad as I've seen it, but it was not as patient and tolerant as the American airlines. I often fly to the Middle East, and you know, people have already unclipped their seatbelts as the plane is landing and getting their bags from some of the airlines anyway, from the overhead lockers. So it's a different scene.
Wow. Well, you know, these kind of perspectives are unique to us, so I'm glad you share those with us.
Yes, very nice.
And you liked our pizza.
I did like your pizza. You had excellent pizza, amazing pizza, in fact. The food was really good, but I think it was for somebody like me that's sort of in their early 40s and not being able to shed any pounds. It was dangerously, deliciously greasy and lovable. And I would definitely become very big on that diet and love it all the way. But I didn't like the coffee, unfortunately. I'm one of those kind of cappuccino, Italian style mocha type people, like a Starbucksy thing. But we've got lots of stores like that here. My favorite one is Neron. I have an extra hot mocha with cream and an extra shot of coffee, and I just have that at my train station or my little platform in the morning and sort of drink it down as coffee number one on my commute into London. You know, I live just outside of London, Surrey. And yeah, that's kind of my survival guide. You know, I get my extra hot Italian style frothy coffee, leave early, travel slow. That's a London survival guide. And just don't take it personally, whatever happens to you on the way.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we had pizza together the last night because everybody went down to the hotel bar, restaurant bar, to have something to eat, and only to discover they closed the restaurant.
I know.
And they were closing the bar, too, but they let us sit there and order pizza from an outside delivery place.
Yeah. That was nice. I mean, so they closed us down, but they didn't say that we couldn't, you know, we couldn't exist. Yeah, they let us carry on. He was a nice barman. He was very nice.
Yes. And it was quite the exciting evening because all these other people joined us. You know, we had Travis Walton, Fire in the Sky.
Uh-huh.
That was awesome. And Bobo, yes. James Bobo Fay from Finding Bigfoot on TV.
I'd left by the time he came, actually. No. I think I was there when Cliff was there and Travis was there. And Bobo came later after I'd gone to bed because I had that 4:30 flight or wake up before getting to the airport.
Oh, no. Missed Bobo.
I spoke to him in the conference. He's a very nice guy. He came over and he said, "Hey, it's Beast of Britain. I'm so glad you're here." And in my mind, I was thinking, is he just reading, being polite and reading my T-shirts on the stand? Or does he know who I am? Please be, let it be the second one and not the first one. And he's just, you know, a polite, nice guy who knows how to introduce himself to another speaker. But it was enough for me. And I took it as being read that it was the second one.
Okay, yes.
And that's what I'm keeping. He gave me a T-shirt. It was very nice. Exchanged a book for a T-shirt and took one of the books. Again, and gave me one of his nice Bobo Bigfoot Tours T-shirts, which was lovely. But that, you know, that whole chat we had with Cliff and Travis was very funny because we're talking to Travis and all he actually spoke about to me nonstop was how freakishly strong his young, skinny son is. The youngest son is very weedy looking, apparently, but is the strongest one. And he went through a whole list of all of this sort of fairground style strength tests that he's beat everybody on. And I just thought, this is an insane conversation for an abductee. And because, of course, he talks all over the world, so I expect that side of it's a bit more boring. And you're just going to make chit chat like anybody would. When I was in the cryptozoology conference in Maine, actually, after the first day, we all went for dinner in some dreadful seafood restaurant. And I don't say that willy-nilly. We were all told it was an amazing place and everybody was like horrified about what happened. But we had a great time together. And one of the people there was Jeff Meldrum. And apart from an initial bit of a chat about Todd Standing, which I promised myself I wouldn't ask him about, I saw him in the lift on that same day in the morning, and this little light when I was saying, bing, don't ask Jeff about Todd Standing. He doesn't want to talk about Todd all the time. So, cool, didn't ask him. Saw him at the conference, bing again, didn't ask him. We get to the dinner, Katie's facing him and says, "So tell me about this whole thing about Todd, Jeff." Katie Elizabeth, the champ lady, says this to him. And I said, "Oh, Jeff doesn't want to talk about that, Katie. He talks about Todd all the time, Todd Standing." And Katie said, "No, I'm talking about Todd Dissertel that gave the speech today." I said, "Oh, no." Then I explained to Jeff that I'd been through this whole terrible mental process of trying not to ask him about Todd all day. And he was like, "I don't mind talking about Todd." And he gave me like a whole half an hour his point of view about what he thought about the whole thing. And then for the rest of the 2.5 hours, we just talked about being daddies. That was it. And another strange, normal conversation, like you'd expect from a human, right? Human out there. He's got 9 children from 2 marriages. I think that's the last 3 are stepchildren. I seem to remember that they are. I might be wrong. But the first 6 are his and their sons. He's got six sons. And I've got two girls who are 5 and 2. I'm 42 years old. And most of the time, I just feel like I'm going to die of exhaustion. And I just thought about having six sons. How would you survive that? And then get married again to somebody who has three other children, like two daughters and another son, I think. And I just looked at him as this guy, never mind the research and the amazing, you know, he's a tenured professor claiming to believe that Bigfoot exists and investigating. That's brave enough. That's nothing compared to this 9 children thing. He's the bravest man I know.
Maybe he goes out looking for Bigfoot to get away from all those kids.
Maybe that's it. He's just got to get out of the house.
You never know. You never know.
Could be. Could be.
So tell me about your looking for. Do you go out searching for cryptids? And like, what have you gone looking for other than Champ in America? You went looking for our lake monster.
Yes. I mean, I was first and foremost a lake monster guy. That was always my thing. For a long time. And the Bigfoot thing is a newish thing to me, maybe 2-3 years. Now, as far as lake monsters go, I've been to Loch Ness 3 times, so any normal lake monster fan would. And, you know, that kind of area is, it's a very difficult research area. I mean, for a start, it's so murky and deep. It's about 750 feet deep, they think, in parts. It's only 1.5 miles across. 25 miles long, more or less, but it's surrounded by hills and forests. So before the sightings started in the 30s, you know, there was no road, ring road around the loch. It were just mountains that you had to like sail basically down the river to the loch or climb up the mountains to get there. It's the only way you could get there. So this ring road now is still mostly obscured by trees and forest and all kinds of things. It's very rural, the whole area. Then there's all the sort of evangelical, skeptic and believer type researchers that are all stationed around there. That are kind of slightly territorial. There's a bit of a territorial feeling about Loch Ness. Lots of people have their businesses there as well. Like, you know, it's a very productive area for tourism. And then you've got 250,000 plus tourists going around. So that area for me, I never found it very productive going to Loch Ness. You know, there's 31,460 lochs and lochans in Scotland alone. There's plenty of other places that you can visit that nobody's ever touched. But you've got to do Loch Ness. I didn't. I did Lake Windermere for the pilot. Now, their monster is called Bo Nessie. And it's a creature that's very similar to Loch Ness and actually has better photographic evidence than the Loch Ness monster. But the sightings have really just picked up since 2006. You know, a couple of humps, and in fact, a hump and a neck photograph that was taken by a wildlife photographer from some London magazine that had set a game cam there for a day, a new game cam they were testing out, and left at 1 minute intervals. Ellie Williams, her name was. She came back, ran the photos back through, and in the distance, in the misty morning, there's this arched hump and this big long neck out in the lake. So they've had over 12 sightings since 2006, and it's mostly for like a super long snake-like creature that appears to have these ridged kind of bumps at the top, which I always think is the neck coiling in some way, or this arched hump and long neck, and it's been seen by lots of antagonistic witnesses. What was important when we went to the area to film this little teaser trailer is it's such a popular tourist lake anyway, is that the monster's not part of their tourism like Loch Ness. So they're not interested in it. But they have got so much tourism, the locals aren't interested in even entertaining the idea. And those who have seen it, so they've either been locals or tourists, they've been very incidental, antagonistic witnesses. They've been surprised that they saw something and almost reticent to be public about it. You know, it's a strange thing to see. And it's a more conservative part of the world, Cumbria. It's in the north of England, just before Scotland on the map, but you know, close enough to that area. Several lakes: Bathenthwaite Lake, Ullswater. I mean, many, many lakes there, and a river that leads out to the sea, the River Leven. Now, it does have some obstructions, it does have some weirs and dams and things like this, like Loch Ness, but the the assessment, the assumption is that these creatures are amphibious. They've been seen on land, either moves through to the other lakes, or it comes in and out from the sea by some route of some kind. So that's the lake monster stuff. That's all I've done. The British Bigfoot stuff, I've mainly concentrated down here in Surrey, where there's many reports, and being part of the British Bigfoot Research Group as well, on Deborah Hatswell's map of the country, of the different sightings here, we've got different people in different areas that tend to look after their area, and we share reports, which is a really nice way to do it. I've been to see the location of the Box Hill Ape sighting, which is in Surrey, on something called the steps that lead up onto the Surrey Hills. There, it's about 300 feet elevation through this winding forest in this national park. And what you have is these large earthen steps hemmed in with wood. And people walk them with their dogs and they run them. And at the very bottom, there's something called the Stepping Stones, which go over this river into the fields and hills beyond. It's near a town called Dorking, D-O-R-K-I-N-G, in Surrey. And a runner was doing their normal run. Now, if you've seen these steps, I've walked them several times. You'd be insane to run it, but people do it. And it's so steep and it's so long. Anyway, they'd had their run, this run, and she'd sat down in the summer evening, maybe about 9 o'clock, it was still light, to drink her energy drink and recover. When she heard some footsteps coming down the steps and thought, okay, a dog walker, I'll just move to the side. Nobody comes past. And she hears some breathing, feels a nerve, turns around and sees this 6 foot plus tall, hairy man ape, brown and gray fur, domed head, this sort of big jutting square jaw, but with a flat face, this classic Sasquatch-style flat face, separate nose and mouth, no muzzle, staring at her, just looking curiously. And she's unnerved. She, obviously they're stuck like that for about 30 seconds. The creature turns away and walks off, leaves a stale smell behind it. Again, another classic Bigfoot-style attribute. And we've got lots of reports like that here. And keeps looking over its shoulder to check where she is as it's going off, and it disappears around the corner. So there are some pictures of the steps on my Facebook page, and you'll see that they wind around, and they're heavily forested on each side. So as you turn one of the corners, you're lost, basically. You lose sight of whoever's walking there. And that's how it had disappeared. And before she had this sighting, she'd heard wood knocks, but she didn't know what wood knocks were. She could just hear these sounds like wood being hit all around the forest, and she just thought something was going on. She didn't think about it until afterwards and investigating it, actually. So there was that, and a possible bluff charge at another place called Dorking Deep Team nearby.
I'm going to stop you right there, Andy, and we're going to take our two-minute break at the half of the show. And we'll be right back, and you can finish up with that. So stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back with Andrew McGrath.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
It is the secret of the world that all things subsist and do not die, but only retire a little from sight and afterwards return again. Nothing is dead. People find themselves dead and endure the mock funerals and mournful obituaries. And there they stand, looking out the window, sound and well, in some new and strange disguise. This secret must be told to the world, and they must tell it. Because they're not dead, we know this, and we'll prove it. So join Mike and Dave every Monday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for the Odyssey Files. Only on Para-X.
My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the producer and host of Paranormal Encounters podcast series. I am a published author, academic, former legal investigator, and paranormal enthusiast who holds 4 advanced degrees with an interest in parapsychology and life after death issues. I have written about and encountered nearly 100 situations involving the paranormal, with my most frightening experience being a floor-length mirror cycling around in front of me in a haunted room I had stayed in. I invite you to tune in Thursday evenings at 11 o'clock p.m. to 12 midnight Eastern Standard Time, right here on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm Jen Cruz, and this is the Journey Radio Show. When we are not live on the air like we are right now, you can find us at thejourneyradioshow.com. And please like our Facebook page. The links are there. And again, we're showing up as the She Squatchers because we're talking about cryptids and Bigfoot with our guest tonight. So check us out online at shesquatchers.com, and please like our Facebook page. And so we're going to get right back into the show with our guest and friend, Andrew McGrath. He is the author of Beasts of Britain, which is a book and hopefully a new TV series someday. So somebody out there, let's make it happen. Let's put it on our American Works ASAP.
Careful what you wish for, huh?
Well, no. I'll wish for that. You deserve it.
Wonderful. Thank you. I would love it. I would just like to take an entertaining but serious look at some of the things that are out there. The Beasts of thing, it's a series that I'm writing. So the next one is Beasts of North America. I've started writing it, and the whole Champ expedition was about that. That was supposed to be the first chapter that I was to start writing. I think there is a market out there for people who are interested in these things and would like to see it presented from a serious perspective. And in that sense, I don't mean it's some sort of show where we're saying, what was that? What's coming this way? Or I just saw something, but I didn't get it on camera. More like something that's a bit more like River Monsters, which was a great show with that expedition style, investigative reporting, plus a show here called Coast, which was really beautiful. It was about going around the entire coast of Britain and investigating all of the local beautiful places and some of their stories. And in my show, we would go out with the researchers in each area. And that seems to be a feature in all countries, in fact, in Australia and America and Britain. And each area seems to have a couple of local cryptozoologists or paranormal researchers that are looking into their particular local phenomena, which is, of course, natural. You check out what's closest to you, don't you? And that's what we would include, I think. Some beautiful scenery, investigations of cryptids, and interviews with the witnesses, plus who are the people involved in this and how is it affecting their lives. And that's what should be exciting about it. We'll get some science in there as well. You know, we'll make sure that the skeptics get a hand in, because that's very important to this whole thing. Yeah, some of us are, I don't like the term believers, but some of us believe too much and others believe too little. And we just need something logical and practical in between, you know, that looks at evidence across the board, including sightings. So anyway, that's the show. That's what I'm hoping to put forward.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'd love to hear about that. And all the different types of cryptids that you have over there in Britain. Do you believe you have something different than what we have over here?
I don't believe we have many things that are different. So lake monsters and sea monsters tend to correspond to the Nessie type description, or the I'd say Ogopogo-esque description, especially around the areas of the North Sea. The British Bigfoot, a lot of people seem to compare that more to the Almaz or Almasti of Russia. It's more hairless around the face, or at least there's more skin showing and the upper chest, but still presents generally in that bipedal Bigfoot-like presentation. My personal idea about the Bigfoot worldwide, it's and the variations. It's like bears, you know, you've got polar bears, black bears, grizzly bears, moon bears, pandas, sun bears, whatever. They're all bears, essentially, aren't they? They just look different locally in each different place, and that's probably an environmental effect of separation that's happened over time. So I think that our woodwows, as they're referred to in history, and I think that is the correlation, the connection, the hairy man of the forest, of the guardian of the forest, is very similar to the Bigfoot and its various forms, like the Almas and Yeren and Yowie. We've got Dogman reports here, which I struggle with, because that's essentially for me like a rebranding of the werewolf, the Dogman, but in all honesty, there's nothing different about these reports to the Bigfoot reports. I just find it harder to believe. I have to admit that that's my own problem. And see it from an objective point of view, it's the one thing that puts me in the position of the unbeliever having to try to accept the evidence. It gives me a good perspective on what people see when I mention Bigfoot or lake monsters, because I'm in that position with the Dogman. But the sightings are there. Little people sightings, little hairy people. Exactly. So I've got a chapter in the book called The Little People or the Hairy Fairy Folk, which I admit does sound like some sort of fetish club of some kind, but it's not. it's just trying to wonder if these old sightings, these fairy legends or goblin legends, could they be describing, like the Australian Jundjardi, a diminutive form of this Bigfoot? You know, do we have something like that too? And I found a few reports that correspond to that.
So I have a question about that. So are you saying that you're little hairy people, little hairy fairy people? I love that. It rolls off my tongue. The little hairy fairy people of the forest, do they look like little Bigfoots, basically?
Some do. So it was when I'm actually in the book, the line I wrote just before introducing the sightings was that there were, I handpicked a few sightings that had a primate-like element to their appearance, and that I'd selected them to match a theory with which I was at best uncomfortable. So they're there. I mean, it was really the Australian Jundjardi that set me on to this. I was listening to the YowieHunters.com YouTube show. It was a podcast, and they interview Yowie witnesses there in a very classic, matter-of-fact Australian style. And it's awesome because it's hard to make Australians elaborate about details in a fantastical way. They're so down-to-earth. And a lot of the people there, including the Aboriginals they interviewed, talked about the Jundjardi, which is this smaller Bigfoot-style creature. Again, it looks fully grown, but it's about 2 to 3 feet high, slightly higher sometimes. We had a few sightings like that. There was one actually, just to be very briefly, in New Year's Day of 2018, where two golden-maned men covered in hair, like a golden tawny hair, were seen in Errington Woods. And that was by a dog walker. Again, it's in an area called Newmask. And she was walking. She heard some noises, like muttering, and saw 2 3-foot-tall creatures that looked like men covered in tawny colored hair with kind of thick golden manes of some kind. She saw that they were both males, saw their anatomy, and they were very muscular, and got the impression that they were fully grown. They weren't children. They weren't young at all. She said they stared at her. She got her mobile out, and they shot off into the bushes. And there's a few sightings over the years like that, but they're rare. They're very rare. And I'm wondering if this is a creature that was more present in the past, but now exists in very minimal numbers. So it's a theory. I'm putting it out there, but I'm not convinced.
Okay. Now, you might find this interesting, but up here in the Midwest Americas, the Native Americans say, you know, from the Ojibwe tribe and from the Dakota Sioux tribe, say that classify a lot of times the Bigfoot with the little people, that they're like the little people, the same type of class of being, so to speak. Uh-huh. But there's different kinds of little people. Mm. Now, according to the Dakota Sioux, there are the Chahotinas, which is actually spelled Canotina, but it's pronounced Jehotanas, which are the little people of the woodland trees. And if you ask what they look like, they basically look like little Bigfoots that are 2 to 3 feet tall, but they're full grown and they're not Bigfoots at all.
Yeah.
But they look just like them.
Wow.
And they say that they've told me where they are, that the Bigfoots are usually living nearby the Tohotanas in certain places. And they've told me where to go look for them. And so I've seen tellings of this from various Native peoples across the United States about the little hairy people that look like Bigfoot but are full grown at 2 to 3 feet tall. So you bringing that up over in England, that's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. And there's a few stories that relate to it. Now, as I say, with the Djangjari of Australia that set me on that path, I looked into the Hulda folk of Iceland, which is their fairies, and the big believers in Iceland in fairies and goblins, and they'll even redirect roads to avoid these certain rock crop and outcroppings that they assume are the home of these Hulda folk, because they think it's unlucky. I mean, the government will redirect roads to make sure that they don't go through their areas, and they have selected protected areas. That kind of thing can survive in a population like Iceland. That's 350,000 people, right? But, you know, we've got it all over the place. Then you've got the Menehune of Hawaii. And I just thought, you know, even maybe the Orang Pendek is something like this, a small diminutive bipedal primate of the Bigfoot variety that lives somewhere. And maybe we've got the same thing here, that there's a very interesting story here. It actually, just outside of London, a place called Woodford Bridge, Greater London, and a pensioner, an old lady, in 2008, she had an encounter. She'd just come out of her flat, her apartment. Just as she turned the corner, she saw a hairy man come out of nowhere, 4 feet tall, really big feet, which is funny that she mentions this. I looked straight at her with animal eyes and then leapt straight over a wall into a local pub, into a garden there. Some of these pubs have big gardens, and disappeared. And, you know, it's very interesting that she'd mentioned the feet, that it was only 4 feet tall, that it had this animal look, but it was bipedal. There's a few sightings like that, but and even in the book, it didn't have enough sightings to even fill a couple of pages, 4 or 5 reasonable sightings that I could actually include along these lines. And of course, all of our other fairy and hobgoblin and in Wales and Ireland, Scotland, you've got different names from grugachs and all these different things that exist, and just different translations of the same thing, like a park or a puka. They're historical, they're mythical, you know, it's hard to match them. I try not to force it, but you'll see if you read the book that there's something to the theory. I think there's stronger evidence in other countries, like what you've just mentioned here in the US, and whatever we had seems to be something that's in steep decline.
So when they talk about the fairy people, you know, I've heard fairy people from Ireland and you're closer to that than we are, of course, but is this something that people talk about being, you know, careful of encountering?
It depends. Some of the Celtic countries, and Ireland is one of the Celtic countries, is one of the Celtic nations that's remained very much as it was because of their separation from the English. So even when the English ruled them, they were primarily still Irish. We in Wales, you know, were very close to the English and the Scottish too, and had more of a cultural mixing or infraction, you know, from those Anglo values. So we've lost a lot of it. In Ireland, there's a lot of fairy circles that people won't go near, and there's a lot of sacred stones or fairy homes and different woods that people will avoid, because they're supposed to be the homes of these things. And that seems to be more in a very rural setting. And even then, you know, it's more of a superstition that's playfully put forward. But you can see there's some seriousness underlying it, you know, more in the older people. I'm not saying people of even my age or younger, but the older people might definitely follow some of those rules and avoidances. Yeah, so it does exist. Not so much in the UK anymore. I think it's something of yesterday, of which we've got possibly small remnants left, as we see with this New Year's Day sighting this year in the country. And as to what they are, I don't know. But my guess is, being on the sort of naturalistic side of things, a diminutive form of this woodwose, this Bigfoot creature that we have.
Very cool. Very cool. So, okay. We've got about 10 minutes left of the show.
Okay.
And I do want to find out where you're going with all of this. You know, you've got your book out there, The Beasts of Britain. Go out and get that, everybody. It's available on Kindle and on Amazon. So go get the Beasts of Britain book. Go get it. I hear it's a lot cheaper on the Kindle, so feel free to do that.
It is a lot cheaper on the Kindle, yeah.
So it's by Andrew McGrath, Beasts of Britain. Go get that. And then, of course, anybody out there with TV connections, let's get him on our TV. Go have a look at his Beasts of Britain teaser trailer. It's on YouTube, right?
It's on YouTube.
Yes. So you mentioned that you're working on a new book.
I am. So Beasts of North America. Now, this is a subject that's been covered by many, many people in North America. Cryptozoology is, as a study, has many, many more adherents than we have in the UK. And you seem to have more of a mix of different cryptids than we have. You know, we're a small island, and that's actually probably quite reflected in the amount of creatures that appear in the book, or the amount of different types of creatures that appear in the book. Whereas this is a really big area, but you also suffer from something, we experience here a lot, which is this mythical mix of historical creatures that could be real, but have sort of legend and myth attached to them. You have to work your way through that sometimes. And there's a new thing that's happening as well, which is people are projecting spiritual need or meaning onto things that they're experiencing or interested in. So you get it with a lot of paranormal Bigfoot or gifting or telepathic Bigfoot encounters. And I think what can happen there sometimes is, you know, with this recession of corporate religion in our Western societies, that sometimes we can search for more spiritual meaning than we're actually experiencing in the creature itself. Perhaps it's just an animal and we're projecting onto that. Now, having studied religion, you know, myself in the past, as my degree, learning about all the religions, especially the denominations of Christianity, you can see how they change environmentally in every different country and place that they're in. And I think that's the same with a lot of our cryptids, especially Bigfoot. It's a good example of that. You know, you can lose friends over liking a Todd Stanley video or believing in portals or whatever. And for me, it's all, you know, it's all up for grabs. It's all up for grabs. I've always been happy to disagree with somebody and still like them, because it doesn't matter to me that they disagree with me. We're just talking, right? Just talking. And it's always the same. So if you say it's portals and I say it's flesh and blood, well, we know our standpoints. We can argue the points. And once we come to the impasse, we still believe the same things. We like each other. We shake hands and we talk about something else, you know?
Exactly. So,
Jeff's kids or Travis's super strong son or something else, you know.
Exactly.
And that's the way this whole thing should be. I would like more unity in cryptozoology and disunity at the same time. We're unified in saying we're all studying similar things in a different fashion from a different point of view, but we've got to kind of come together and at least be friendly to get through this, because it's already a fringe science. Let's not split ourselves any further than we have to.
Right, exactly. And for myself as a researcher, I have an open mind, but I don't like to form beliefs too quickly. I like to see things for myself. I don't like to just believe in something without seeing it. I'm kind of a skeptical person, but open-minded at the same time.
No, I understand.
And even though I'm part Native American and I enjoy hearing the traditional cultural stories that would include portals and things like that, of tellings of Bigfoot stories, I still had a hard time putting my mind around accepting that.
Yeah.
Until I saw something that would go along with that. Then it was like, well, hey, that kind of goes along with what I heard.
So there you go. I mean, there you go. And I think that's what you should be looking for, essentially. Now, I keep asking myself that question. Andy, if you get out there and suddenly, you know, three little men jump out of a portal and you've been flesh and blooding it this whole time, what are you going to say? And of course, I've decided I'll hide the evidence and just go on with what I'm doing. Kidding, just kidding. But yeah, you know, I mean, it would be a big shock. I'd have to turn myself around and try to explain that. And I would hopefully be honest and not try to explain it away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah, that goes to a good question, doesn't it? What would you do if you find out that you've been wrong all this time? That's kind of hard for some people to grab a hold of.
I'm married. I'm wrong all the time. I'd be perfectly fine with that.
Oh, he's a good husband, too. He's a good husband.
I just know the rules. I read the small print. I signed. I know the rules. And I was actually a feminist before I got married. This is a joke I tell everybody, but it's a true joke that I'm from a very feminist kind of family. And my wife, although very modern, has lots of traditional views on things. So I often have to fight the feminist side in the relationship. I have to fight for it.
There you
which
go.
Is funny.
That is funny. That is funny.
That is funny. Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear that she supports you in your monster quest, so to speak.
She does. She does in a very honest way. So I say to her, they're real, you know, they're really real. And she says, Andy, I know they're real, but I don't care.
Oh, she knows, but she doesn't care.
But it doesn't affect my life in any way. I'm really happy that you like it, and I'm happy for you to be into it and give you all the support you need. I just don't need to know about any of this stuff. And it's the best kind of marriage you can have. It's my thing. It's only my thing. I'm not interfered with. She totally supports it. She's honest about not being interested. But then you've got my support. Do your books, do your series, go on your investigations. I think it's great. But if they're real, they're not real, it doesn't affect my life one bit. And that's a good opinion to have. And a lot of people think that that's quite harsh. I like that. And that's why we got married. She always told me the truth right from the very start. We've never had an awkward silence.
That is very awesome. That is very awesome. That is good stuff. You should write a How to Be Happily Married book too.
Yeah, just say yes. To everything.
Yes, dear.
To everything.
That's very good. That's very good. I love that. I love that. So when might we expect to see your Beasts of North America book come out?
I'm hoping to finish by, I plan to do it in about 6 months. I'm hoping April, May, maybe next year. I would like to get a proper publisher for this one, but I mean a separate publisher. I did have a publisher for the first one, but I put it on Amazon because there were better odds at the time than I was being offered. Yes, so hopefully by May next year, I'm writing. And for all of the listeners out there, if they want to contact me on facebook.com/beastsof or any of the profiles that I'm on and offer any unreported sightings or talk to me about any types of cryptids in North America or anywhere else, I'd really, really appreciate that. I'm researching. I'm looking for, you know, for unusual things. And I'll always reply to you. Absolutely, 100%.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, he's looking for reports, everybody. So let him know your true sightings and information that you have to share. And maybe it'll be in his next book and potential TV series.
Yeah.
What would you call it? Would it be Beasts of a TV series if it was all over the world?
Yeah, I guess it would have to be. I mean, I've already kind of taken the name just in case. Beasts of series, and I put the dots afterwards. I'm not totally convinced that that's the right thing. Because Beasts of Britain was initially just the idea, but I've got them for every region in the world now. And I've got them all laid out, the whole sort of 5 to 6 year plan of the different books in different regions. And of course, based in North America, Europe, etc., they're bigger books because it's all the countries, not just one like we did with Britain. And for you guys, it's all the states, which essentially to me are the countries of North America, aren't they? The different states, they're very different places. As I found, going from Maine to Kentucky, to Vermont to Kentucky. What was it, Maine? Somebody needs to go far to the car. to park the car. And don't go far.
Very true.
It's wonderful. Anyway, yeah. Awesome.
We're coming. We're right at the end of the show here. So we're going to have to say goodnight. And okay. I want to thank Andy McGrath for coming on the show. And please do go check out his book, Beasts of Britain. And you can find it on Amazon. And the Kindle version is your better bet if you're looking to save some money and get it right now. And again, he's looking to pitch his TV series. Go check out his YouTube, Beasts of Britain teaser trailer on YouTube. You can find Andy on Facebook, Beast of Britain, and this has been the Journey Radio Show and the She Squatchers. So good night, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Keep it squatchy, everyone.